You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll check out Wisconsin Bike Week and find out what's going on in communities around the state.
First, earlier this week, the Wisconsin Legislature's Budget Committee restated their opposition to Governor Walker's plan for self-insurance for state workers. The committee said other benefits changes could save $60 million without resorting to self-insurance.
David Wahlberg joins us now. He's a health reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Well, what did the Budget Committee have to say about self-insurance earlier this week?
Well, so under Governor Walker's proposed budget, he was looking to save $60 million from state worker health benefits by shifting to self-insurance. And the Joint Finance Committee has repeatedly said they don't want to do that. They said that again this week, and basically they said they would find that $60 million in other ways.
And did they get into the specifics about what other ways they could accomplish this without self-insurance?
They didn't get too detailed yet, but they suggested that some things could include a modest increase in deductibles and also expanding wellness programs, you know, providing incentives for people to become healthier, for example.
I want to back up for just a moment to make sure we're all on the same page. We use the term self-insurance. Can you describe for us again what it is and how it would work?
Yeah, so currently the state pays premiums to 17 HMOs to cover about 250,000 state workers and some local government workers and their family members. Under self-insurance, the state would have the program, they would run the program themselves and take on the risk for medical claims themselves and not pay premiums to HMOs. They would, however, hire a few companies to administer the program. So the big change is who controls the risk. Right now, HMOs take on the risk. Under self-insurance, the state would take on the risk. And I should point out that most large employers do self-insurance.
And as a litmus test, how is the Joint Finance Committee feeling about the prospect of taking on that risk?
Well, they have said that they don't want to do it for a few different reasons. One, they're concerned about the budget, and they're concerned that in some years the state might lose a lot of money this way, and it's kind of unpredictable, and so that could affect other programs. They also have expressed concern about the impact on the health insurance market statewide. Wisconsin has a much more competitive health insurance market than most states, and most of the health plans are owned by regional health systems. And so legislators who, you know, represent the districts around the state have expressed concern about the impact to those insurance plans and the providers.
And one thing that seems as though it will go forward regardless is the number of insurers that will be accessible down the road. I think it was something from 18 to 6. Can you talk about that?
That's true, yes. There are currently 18 plans overall, and it gets really confusing because actually one of them is a self-insured plan, but most people are covered by the 17 HMOs. So, correct. The Group Insurance Board that oversees state worker benefits would be able to shift to sort of a regional program and use fewer health insurance companies, regardless of what the Joint Finance Committee decides. And they've expressed an interest in doing that. So, basically, many of the players currently involved wouldn't be, although some of them could still be.
We're talking right now with David Wahlberg, health reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, and he's with us for an update on self-insurance for Wisconsin state workers. And have we heard anything from the HMOs involved, from spokespeople for those organizations and also from state workers themselves?
Yeah, well, the Wisconsin Association of Health Plans, which represents many of those HMOs, they've repeatedly said that they're opposed to self-insurance, and they've noted that the state's health worker, the health plan, has had relatively low premium increases in recent years, lower than the national average. And so they argue that that shows that the current program works well. In recent days, they've reacted to something the Walker administration said last week, and that is that if the state doesn't shift to self-insurance, premiums would have to go up 10% next year. And so the Walker folks are saying, you know, that's a reason why we should do this, because premiums would otherwise really go up. This health worker insurance, health insurance group is saying that's not true. That's just based on initial estimates, which always go down again. And then it was interesting, John Nygren, one of the leaders of the Joint Finance Committee, when they were discussing other ways to get the savings this week, he talked about increase in deductibles and said that, as far as he knows, state worker groups seem to be supportive of that. They'd rather contribute a little bit more to their health benefits than switch to self-insurance. And that may be the case, but today AFSCME, one of the unions for state workers, came out and said, just a minute, we really don't want to pay more for our health insurance. We think the savings should come from insurance company profits instead.
Hmm. And have state workers had to say it? Obviously, there's a difference of opinion exactly there about which way to go, but whether part of the concern is a disruption in care. So you're seeing one doctor and suddenly maybe under self-insurance, but maybe in general, not based on what we know, you have to see a different care provider.
That could be true. The Department of Employee Trust Funds, which administers the benefits, they've come out and said that I believe it's 98% of providers would still be available under self-insurance. So it's a fairly small portion of providers that, you know, wouldn't be there. However, it's probably a slightly larger percentage of workers that might have to shift doctors, because some people would have to shift health plans. It's a little confusing. But basically, the disruption arguably should be relatively minimal, but not nothing.
And so the governor has been a big advocate of self-insurance. And as you said, the Joint Finance Committee, not so much. So what happens next at this kind of impasse right now?
Well, the Joint Finance Committee, you know, needs to sign off on the self-insurance contracts for them to go forward. I don't quite understand how the gubernatorial veto works in this scenario. I suppose it could come into play. But basically, if the budget committee doesn't approve this, which they have a hearing next week, and they've basically said that they are going to vote this down after that, then it looks like they might have to work harder on finding other ways to come up with the $60 million and perhaps work with the administration on that.
And any signs right now about what direction the wind is blowing on that? If it looks as though they'll vote it down as it does at this moment, what is the most likely place to start looking for savings?
Well, you know, on one hand, Walker's administration is definitely not letting up on this. They are still arguing that this is the best way to go, that even though the Legislative Fiscal Bureau came out with a slightly smaller savings estimate last week, they said $47 million as a base savings as opposed to $60 million. They're still saying, look, that's tens of millions of dollars we could be saving. And they're pointing out that most large employers do this, so why isn't Wisconsin? But if it does come down to finding other ways to get the savings, I think we'll hear more about details like deductibles. And also there's been a fair amount of talk about the reserves that are available for this program. The Fiscal Bureau report also pointed out that the reserves are currently above what the guidelines call for. And so the Joint Finance Committee is saying, let's study those reserves and maybe use some of those to achieve some of the savings.
David, thanks a lot for joining us.
No problem. Good to be here.
That was David Wahlberg, health reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, joined us for an update on the prospect of self-insurance for Wisconsin state workers. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at Wisconsin Bike Week.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Today we bring you another story from Time Slips, a creative process for people with memory loss based on the therapeutic power of stories.
My name is Carlos Rodriguez, and I am a Time Slips facilitator here at St. Anne's. Time Slips, pretty much, the way I look at it is being the creator of a story, and we give them a picture and ask them questions about what they see in that picture, and it's really up to them. They pretty much just create their own story, and at the end, we read it back to them. Today we had, the only image that we had actually today was lighting candles, and we asked them questions like, can you tell us a story about the, you know, what you see on the picture? What colors do you see?
Don Julio, cuando ve esta foto, ¿cuál es la primera cosa que se le viene a la mente cuando ve la foto? ¿Ve esta foto aquí?
La abuela que está muerta.
¿Cómo dice?
La abuela que está muerta.
¿Una abuela que está muerta?
He says that a story would be his grandma who passed away.
Yeah.
I think that was actually pretty powerful because Julio, you know, he's at that age, he thinks of his family a lot. And every time I have a conversation with him, he actually always brings up his family back in Cuba. So I think that's pretty powerful. I have my grandma who actually has Alzheimer's, but she lives in Honduras and obviously I can't see her. And I grew up with her in Honduras. I was born and raised, you know, in her home, and she, you know, she raised me. I was very close to her, and when we moved to the United States, she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and you know, it was hard to hear that she was going through that, and now it's a lot more advanced than it was, you know, when I first moved here, and now she doesn't recognize me. But every time I talk to her over the phone, she tells me stories about my grandpa when they first met, and I just wish that I could be there in person, you know, helping her. What I've learned here, I brought it to her. And I think that's the reason why I decided to do this, because I feel like being connected to, you know, elderly people here in the U.S. is some sort of connection with my grandma who's not in the U.S. Every time I've had a conversation with him, he's had an impact. One of the most powerful thing that Julio and I talked about before was him being from Cuba. One day we were talking about a picture, and there was a family having dinner, and I asked him what they were celebrating during that dinner, and he said the government and Cuba, that's what they were celebrating. And I said, what is it? He knew specific dates, and I actually Googled it when I went back home, and he was right. It was exactly the day when Fidel Castro took power in Cuba. When I first moved to the United States, I had no knowledge of the language. And I remember being in, what, 7th, 8th grade, and I was held back a year because of my language barrier. But I remember not talking to anyone in class, because even though I was in a bilingual school, even though majority of the students were Latinos, they wouldn't really talk to me in Spanish. And I felt very isolated from everyone, which I think it's what had happened with Julio.
Oh, that's okay.
What other colors do we see?
The story was produced in partnership with Time Slips. Thanks to Angela Fingard and Ann Basting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, last week kicked off a tradition known as Wisconsin Bike Week, a celebration of all things bicycling in our state.
Dave Cheslevich joins us now. He's executive director for the Wisconsin Bike Federation. Dave, welcome back to Central Time.
Great, thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to the fun stuff of Bike Week, there is some policy action looking at your website. We've talked to you about this before, vulnerable user legislation.
Right.
People have been talking about it. What is that? What's going on?
So basically, it's legislation that increases penalties for drivers who kill or seriously injure a cyclist, pedestrian, or really anyone else by their actions. And these are things like moving violations, which normally wouldn't be associated with a different kind of penalty. So, for example, if you're drinking and driving, well, that's a serious offense. If you leave the scene, that's a serious offense. But if you're just guilty of a moving violation and you happen to kill or injure someone, you can get away with a fine as little as $30. So this bill increases those penalties from $500 to $1,000 and also requires some remedial driver's education training. And that bill just passed through the Assembly Committee. It's available for scheduling.
And this has been talked about for years, right?
It has. We did have a stronger bill before the legislature a couple sessions ago that could not pass, and but we think this is a good step in the right direction.
So here we are, Wisconsin Bike Week. It just started last week, runs until June 11th. What's the idea behind the statewide event?
You know, it's really just to celebrate all things bicycle, you know, at the beginning of the season for a lot of folks. It includes all kinds of activities. It used to be Bike to Work Week, and then we got rid of the to work part because we wanted to emphasize that biking is great for commuting to work, but it's also great for a kid's activity. It's a great way for people to stay in shape as they get older. And there's all kinds of interesting ways that people are using bicycles.
Give us a taste of the kind of events that are going on.
Sure. So there's a complete list on our website, wisconsinbikefed.org. So you can go to that website and you can get a complete listing with times and locations and everything you need. But I promise you guys, I could do 17 events in less than a minute. So I'm going to see what I can do.
All right, here. Go for it.
Okay. So just tonight in Madison at Hotel Red at 6:30, we're going to have a program on electric bikes. Those are really starting to take off. If you're e-bike curious, come by Hotel Red at 6:30, and there'll be demonstrations of bikes as well. In Milwaukee this evening, they're unveiling, as we speak, the Beer Garden Bike, which is a traveling beer garden bicycle. County executives doing that. Also in Milwaukee, Bike to Brewer rides are starting all over the city at 5:50. And again, you can go on our website and find out where those begin. Also Bike to Baseball in Eau Claire, starting at the local store at 5:30. In La Crosse, there's a cheeseburger ride, which is a slow roll, he said, through La Crosse. That starts at 5 o'clock at the Pearl Street Brewery. Tomorrow, Thursday, Bacon on the Bike Path here in Madison, 7 to 10 at Law Park. Also Bacon on the Bike Path in Milwaukee, 1500 East Park Place. Also Milwaukee County Bike Ride tomorrow, County to Work, Bike Ride to Work. And in La Crosse, a Tour de Java, which is obviously going to different coffee shops. On Friday, Kittical Lobby Day at Pierre Marquette Park in Milwaukee, 10 a.m. Kids are going to write notes to their alders about the need for safe biking and deliver them to City Hall. In La Crosse, a family-friendly bike scavenger hunt Friday evening. Madison, Bike Week Party, 5:30, 100 block of South Pinckney Street. In Eau Claire, Bikes, Bridges, and Brews are going to bike over some of the beautiful bridges in Eau Claire and then stop at a brew pub. Saturday in Eau Claire, Take a Kid Mountain Biking Day. In Milwaukee, the Olmsted Ride, visiting parks designed by Frederick Law Olmsted. Also, the Pride Ride, which is part of Pride Fest at Reservoir Park. And finally, on Sunday in Milwaukee, this is really cool, probably my favorite event, Cyclovia. So they open the streets to cycling, but they also give away 1,000 bikes to kids in Milwaukee, and not just bicycles, but also helmets, and they'll be fitted for helmets, and they'll get bicycle locks. This is run by the 16th Street Community Center.
And you mentioned lobbying there at a local level. So yeah. As we know, the state and any local government is going to have a finite transportation budget. People think first often of cars and roads. Why make the case that they should leave some room and some budget room for bikes and bike safety?
Sure. Actually, it's one of the best things you can do for your budget, because if you can imagine it, every bicycle on the road or bicycle on a bicycle path means that much less wear and tear on roads. One of the most expensive things in any city budget is rebuilding or maintaining streets. And so obviously a bicycle is going to cause less of that. They also take up less room and demand less parking. Every parking stall in the city of Madison, for example, that's built underground, it's $60,000 every stall. You build them above ground, $15,000 to $30,000. So cars are a very expensive proposition, and bicycles are a good way to to do something to make your budgets go a little bit easier.
What is your view on the state of bicycling policy here in Wisconsin in 2017?
You know, Wisconsin has been recognized as one of the top 10 states for cycling in terms of policy for many years now. We're a little concerned. State money has been cut back for cycling programs. Some of the state policies have not been what we wanted. The legislature did repeal our complete streets law, which was unfortunate. But we're hopeful. AB 201, the vulnerable user law, looks to be something that will pass. We're working hard in the legislature to get more funding for local road aids. That's fixing the potholes and repaving the streets and paving shoulders, places where people ride bikes. So we're reasonably optimistic about the future.
And how about a message for people out there listening, thinking, I could get my bike tuned up finally this summer. It's been sitting in the garage for 3-4 years. Make the case that people should get out and bike, whether to work or wherever.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's a great way to get some exercise, particularly, you know, people are leading busy lives. They can't always get to the gym. They can't always set aside time for a workout. But, you know, if your bike commute to work is, say, half an hour or 45 minutes, you know, you're probably putting on a few miles right there, and you're getting exercise, burning up some calories. And studies show that you can arrive at work more relaxed and more alert, and you'll probably be more productive at work as well. And it's a great way to stay in shape if you just want to do it for exercise. You know, a lot of us did a lot of running in our youth, and we have the knees to show for it. And the great thing about cycling is it's low impact. So it's something you do. Senator Fred Risser, 90 years old, he's going to bike 90 miles sometime this month to celebrate his 90th birthday, so you can keep doing it.
And briefly, as we wrap up, do you have a bike tour plan for this summer?
You know, I'm going to take a lot of tours around the state. I always do the Door County Century. I love that. I was up at the Elroy Sparta Trail over the weekend. We do the Ride Across Wisconsin, which is a bike fed event from Dubuque to Kenosha. So I'll be part of that. I'm going to do quite a bit of riding.
Dave, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks.
That's Dave Cieslewicz, Executive Director for the Wisconsin Bike Federation. We've been talking about Wisconsin Bike Week happening now until June 11th. Now, by some measures, men are expected to die about 5 years earlier than women, and they're more likely to die from an unintentional injury or from suicide. Alongside all that, men are less likely to seek out medical care, especially when it comes to mental health issues. June is Men's Health Month, a month devoted to the health issues that affect men and how to improve men's health in general.
Dr. Michael F. Myers joins us now. He's a specialist in physician health and professor of clinical psychiatry at SUNY Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York. And he's the author of the book, Why Physicians Die by Suicide, Lessons Learned from Their Families and Others Who Cared. Dr. Myers, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, why are men more reluctant than women are to seek out medical care?
Okay. Big question, but I prepared for it. It goes way back, of course. And it's probably good that we don't generalize, which is a tendency to do that. But the one thing I did want to say is that men vary, of course, and our reluctance to maybe seek mental health care also varies with our age, also with our culture, or our race, or things like that. So, for instance, young men, actually across the board, seem a little bit more open to going forward to receive mental health care. My colleagues who work in the military even notice that a bit, too, that it's a lot better than the generation before, although there's still, you know, a lot of concern and stigma about that sort of thing. I think it's got a lot to do with a need to be independent and be so-called autonomous or to be rugged, self-sufficiency. It's kind of a tired old joke, but it's like, you know, men don't easily ask for directions either when they get lost driving. Now with GPS, maybe it's a little bit different. But the other thing, too, is that sometimes the way that men experience symptoms of mental illness isn't always quite the same. Like, for instance, they may put up with a lot before they conclude that, you know, I'm really I'm really sick, or this isn't getting better. And that could be that they've dealt really, really severe difficulty sleeping, or they lost massive amount of weight, or they started to develop thoughts of suicide. So those might be kind of a wake-up call, whereas somebody else, especially women, would go earlier, you know, when they're not feeling well. So there's that. Other things to have, sometimes men, their symptoms are more physical. Like, in other words, they could be going through a rough time in their life, and you ask them, how are you feeling? Well, pretty good, but this back pain I've got is just killing me. I need to go to a back doctor, that sort of thing. And all of the primary care physicians, they're aware of this as well, and they screen very carefully for, like, an undiagnosed depression or something like that that could be going on. We call it somatization, where they develop more physical symptoms expressing their anxiety and depression.
Oh, so you're saying there are the depression is the underlying cause, but there's these physical symptoms that get focused on instead, I guess, of the mental health issues.
Yeah, and actually, what a primary care doctor does is kind of do a very, of course, an important screening, and that's both taking of what we call a good and accurate history as well as a physical exam, and then maybe just some what we call cursory tests. And then if nothing shows up, then maybe the hunch that this is somebody who's quote-unquote somatizing. And then they try their best to see if that same individual would be open to perhaps taking a medication or going to a psychologist or other therapist to talk about this. Because they might say, you know, you've got every reason to have a severe back pain. You know, your wife of 35 years died 3 months ago. And that seems to be roughly about the length of time that you've been having so much trouble with your back. Do you think it could be related, that sort of thing? Because that man wouldn't necessarily have put two and two together.
So is this something that physicians are aware of, to be on the lookout that, hey, this might not be just back pain, that you have to look at the context of the whole person to get the complete picture of their health, mental and otherwise?
Oh, absolutely. If you talk to a range of primary care physicians, they will say that, well, you know, it ranges, but they'll say, oh, my gosh, you know, I'm doing so much psychiatry, you know, through the course of my day. And we in psychiatry really see the primary care docs as kind of like the frontline people. And many of them are very experienced also in both diagnosis as well as prescribing, you know, some medications. But when it gets too complicated, that's when, of course, it warrants a referral, you know, to a psychiatrist, including a psychologist or clinical social worker to do the psychotherapy, which is so important in any treatment of any psychiatric illness.
We're talking with Dr. Michael F. Myers right now, specialist in physician health and professor of clinical psychiatry at SUNY Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York. He's the author of Why Physicians Die by Suicide. And Dr. Myers, you used the word rugged before, which kind of gets at this idea of a masculine culture, which as Americans, we kind of grew up with along over the decades, the idea of the American West being tough, being strong. But do you think that is changing now, that men, you talked about those generational differences, so do you think this is something that might be phasing out?
Well, that's what I'm hoping. And also, I'm defining ruggedness very broadly as well, including, you know, sort of the group that you're thinking of, the West and physical prowess and hard labor, but also rugged in a kind of Wall Street sense. I don't have time. I don't have time to go see a shrink or something like that. If I work harder and, you know, kind of get to the gym, that'll be enough, and make sure I don't drink too much. And, you know, those things are important as well. But if they've got, you know, something pretty serious going on there, it's, you know, those things will help a bit, but not enough, you know, for them to, you know, to get feeling better. And that's why I'm very glad that you're doing this program, because those of us who work in the world of suicide see this as such a serious thing. And one of the things that I noticed in the research that I did for this book on physician suicide is that roughly 10-15% of the families that I interviewed had lost their physician loved one to suicide without that individual ever receiving any care at all. And those are doctors. Those are doctors who were well, got ill, and then died by suicide. So, in other words, they didn't go to a primary care physician. They didn't go to a psychologist or other therapist. They didn't go to the clergy. They didn't go to primary care, things like that.
And I'm presuming you're talking here about doctors who are men who I guess would have those doctors know their own health, know their own bodies, know what symptoms to look for, and yet they didn't, and something went wrong. Do you have a thought about why?
Oh, I do. That's the irony and, of course, the paradox of this. It's well known that many primary care physicians in the United States don't have primary care doctors themselves. I mean, it's something that we're promoting a lot and have been for a long time, but many of them will argue, well, I don't really need one because I'm trained in general medicine, so if I get trouble with my heart, I'll just go to a cardiologist. Or if I notice, you know, a change in my digestion, I'll go to a gastroenterologist or something. But that's not always the best way to do it because, again, they could have something going on that isn't either of those things, but they might have a somatic form of a psychiatric illness themselves. But it's for the similar reasons, but the one thing, though, I do want to highlight is the stigma associated with going for professional help. And I think that occurs across the board, of course, in men and women. But when it's in a man, it's this fearfulness that, you know, is this indeed going to be confidential? Could there be any leakage? Is this going to affect my employability, my health insurance? And in physicians, could it affect my malpractice insurance? Will I be able to get my medical license renewed? Or am I going to have to answer a bunch of questions? So that contributes a lot to the fearfulness about getting what I would call much needed as well as life-saving psychiatric care.
And that gets at some research I read about, too, that even if that man does reach out and make an appointment at a primary care physician, maybe with a therapist, that there might be problems with holding back all of the information, not telling all of it. Some of it might not be pretty and might make the individual feel vulnerable. Do you see that sort of honesty question coming into play?
Yes, absolutely. And I always encourage the people I train in physician health who are beginning to look after physicians to be patient, that a lot of stuff is not going to come out at first unless somehow you've got the magic wand. But most patients, including physicians, they really need to develop a relationship of trust with somebody that they're going to disclose some of those darker things in their life, and because they're so afraid of being judged they're so ashamed or guilty about those things. But yet that's precisely the kind of information that the therapist, first of all, needs to know about, and secondly, can really help with. And so you really hit the nail on the head there. That's when it's very important to really, to kind of shed some of that. Whenever you talk, by the way, with anybody, whether a physician or not, who's gone public with their illness and they're out there, you know, when a celebrity goes public with having been diagnosed with bipolar illness or they're in recovery for alcohol abuse or something, they always feel better. They really do. They feel lighter. And they just feel more authentic, and they're tired of living with a shameful secret.
Dr. Michael F. Meyer stays with us now. He's a specialist in physician health and professor of clinical psychiatry at SUNY Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York. And he's with us this Men's Health Month to talk about why men are more reluctant than women in general to seek out medical care.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a man, let us know if you've ever put off going to a doctor when you had a concern. And especially when it comes to mental health, did you feel reluctant at some point in your life to seek help? Did you ultimately? Were you glad you did? Do you feel like sometimes traditional ideas about masculinity get in the way of seeking help? If you are in the healthcare profession yourself, do you see this difference between men and women? On average, are men more reluctant to seek mental health care in general? How do you try to overcome that? How do you try to bridge that gap? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're picking up our conversation now with Dr. Michael Myers, specialist in physician health and a professor of clinical psychiatry at SUNY Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York. And June is Men's Health Month, and we're talking about why men may be more reluctant than women to seek out medical care, and this goes especially for mental health care.
And we want to hear from you with your questions, comments, experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Guys, is this you? Do you put off seeking medical care? Maybe even seeking mental health care. Why do you put it off? Why did you put it off? Did you ultimately seek care? Were you glad you did? If you work in healthcare, what do you see in your patients? And is it harder to get men to share that highly personal detail, maybe? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll take our first caller now. We've got Tim joining us in Appleton. Tim, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I was calling because I really identify with how difficult it was, especially on the mental health aspect of going and seeking health care. I've dealt with anxiety and procrastination most of my life, and it was really, really difficult. I mean, it got to the point where I actually lost my home because of it, and it took 2 years for me to rebuild back.
Tim, I'm sorry to hear about the problems. Can you share with us what it is that finally got you to make that move and get that care?
Really, it actually took for me reaching for me my rock bottom and a lot of encouragement and support from my family at the time. I mean, I was truly blind, and I had to relearn how to live like a normal person.
Wow.
Well, thank you so much, Tim. I really appreciate you calling and telling your story today with us on the radio. And Dr. Myers, what do you hear when you hear Tim's story?
Yeah, Tim, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thank you so much for calling in. I really salute you. And first of all, it's good that you did go for help. Unfortunately, it is often too often like that. You know, we let it go and let it go until, quote unquote, I think you said it, you hit rock bottom. But the good news is that you did go for help, and you must be feeling better enough that you actually picked up the phone and called, and also to say that you could identify with this. I wonder if one thing that might have helped, too, is that one of the things we try to do is explain to, well, both men and women, but especially the men, that, look, this is not about weakness. This has to do with biological changes in your body. And when we're talking, for instance, I know you mentioned anxiety, but, you know, there's a lot of things that we're able to discuss with our patients about what goes wrong with anxiety. For instance, and with depression, I use the line, look, you've run out of neurotransmitters, and this is why I have to prescribe a low dose of medication for you to get them working again. You need them back in your body, just like a person with diabetes needs either insulin or an oral agent in order to keep their blood sugar within the normal range. And so sometimes, at least just, you know, giving that medical explanation really kind of helps to get rid of a lot of the outdated, you know, and kind of, you know, shameful thinking about weakness.
Well, Tim, thanks a lot for calling and sharing, and we appreciate that. We go next to Larry in somewhere in Wisconsin. Larry, hi.
Oh, hello. I was telling the gentleman, I've had a couple of traumatic experiences in my 75 years. The first one was a divorce, and you know, the reason that I think men hold back is, it's kind of like you want to be strong, like an island, not need help. And I was like that as well. And so you just, I'm going to fix this myself. I don't need anybody else. And so I'll just keep on going. And after the divorce, I really changed my life, and I was in a program called Beginning Experience for widowed and divorced people. And I learned that support is out there.
Yeah.
And once you experience that, it really is a change in your life. And I'm glad I had it because 10 years ago my wife was killed in a car accident.
Oh, I'm
right
sorry.
Near my farm, and I had to do it again. So I was glad that I had gained some experience.
Yes.
Beginning
yeah.
on, and I knew that I couldn't do this myself. And I think what I learned is you have to go through the pain. You cannot push it down and hope that it will go away, because it does not go away.
Larry, thank you so much for yeah. calling, and I'm so sorry to hear about yeah. All you've been through. Glad to hear you've learned about what you need and how to get help. And I wonder, Dr. Myers, if that's part of it is maybe a person knows they need help, but it's mysterious about how you get it and the work that's required to figure out where to go to get the help
yeah.
you need.
Yeah. Larry, again, I echo what Veronica said. I thank you for calling in as well. That's really so important in what you've shared. As you say, you've learned a few things in your 75 years and because you've been through a lot, and especially the more recent. The point also that you made about grieving, it is true. You know, that, this is why so many people who have lost someone, they hate the word closure, because they say, you know, it's not really about closure. You never really get over it. It gets easier, slowly. But yet, they like expressions more that you persevere, or you prevail, or you move along with it or through it or something like that, but not over, you know, that kind of thing. And Veronica, your question's an important one as well, as to where to start, because sometimes, as Larry mentioned, he got a lot of benefit out of it in the first time around in a support group for separated and divorced and widowed people. And that's, you know, one very important avenue of getting help, you know, and that's, you know, sort of in a group situation. Of course, anybody's got a problem with, you know, alcohol or drugs, and AA and NA are out there. And that's all in addition to any of the other stuff that I mentioned earlier. The vast majority of people do go to their primary care doctor first, but not all of them. Some who are religiously affiliated go to their pastor, their priest, their rabbi, their imam. That's where they start, and they can derive a lot of benefit from that as well. And they may, you know, they may then sort of be referred to somebody who's more medically trained. So.
And again, thanks, Larry, for that call, and wish you well. And Dr. Myers, as we get close to the end here of our time together, what advice can you give to men who may be listening, who maybe haven't always had good experiences when they have reached out, or maybe they haven't reached out and they're working up the courage, or maybe simple areas of health to focus on to get to that goal of wellness? What would you say?
Okay, yes, a couple of things. First of all, anybody listening who's listened to the two men who have called in, I really, you know, see them as beacons, actually, of individuals who did sort of, in a sense, bite the bullet. They went to get help. They're better people for it. That's the other thing, that you will talk with people that will say that I avoided, I was so terrified, et cetera, but I'm so glad I did. And some will make very profound statements like, I wouldn't be alive today if it weren't for A, B, and C. And that's pretty powerful when people speak like that. For those of you who have had a bad experience, please don't give up. You know, there's other people out there. There's other therapists. You may need it, because, you know, you're talking about an interaction between you and a particular individual. And what we say is that maybe it just wasn't a good fit. Or even if that occurred on one, two, or three occasions, still keep looking. To somebody who, as they say in the parlance, somebody who gets you.
And we leave it there. Dr. Myers, a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you very much for having me on the program.
That was Michael F. Myers, specialist in physician health and professor of clinical psychiatry at SUNY Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York, the author of Why Physicians Die by Suicide.